Besides owning something like 15% to 25% of Britain's public debt and a slightly larger ratio of stock in the Bank of England and the British East India Company, Dutch financiers of the 1770s found another rewarding venue. Pushing money on foreign rulers, from Catherine the Great to Frederick of Prussia. Bankers who saw too little return in revitalizing the Zaandam industrial district or Friesland fisheries were happy to underwrite Russian capture of lands along the Black Sea from Turkey. As British historian Charles Boxer has observed, whether Dutch capital was invested at home or abroad, it was lent to bankers and brokers of commercial bills rather than in developing home industries or fostering Dutch shipping. In the 1860s and 1870s, British skeptics wondered if their nation might be doing its own imitation of the Dutch. However, nearer 1914, as the analogy really gained relevance, it was rarely raised. The number and influence of rentiers kept growing. According to one chronicler, by 1871, Britain contained 170,000 persons of rank and property without visible occupation. Stocks and shares, including shares in family firms formed into private companies for this purpose, were a convenient way of providing for widows, daughters, and other relatives. Although not to the extent of Holland, Britain, too, was a nation of citizen creditors, with many in politics or the government owning shares in the consolidated funds. The big British rentier growth was still to come. With each decade, the percentage of investment going overseas grew like a springtime tulip bed. What had been just over £200 million in 1850 became £700 million in 1875, £1 billion in 1900, £3 billion in 1907, and £4 billion in 1914. By 1914, overseas investments were bringing the British investing classes a net annual return of £200 million. A sum that was barely taxed and exceeded the annual budget of His Majesty's government. Owning 43% of the global total of foreign investments, Britons believed themselves to be almost invulnerable economically. Reform-minded political officeholders such as Joseph Chamberlain, the Conservative Party's leading economic nationalist, were dubious about this sense of safety well before 1914. And some academics assessing British decline make a similar complaint. At the very moment when creativity and capital were needed for industrial renewal at home, said historian Paul Thompson, resources were being siphoned away. Clearly, though, the market dictate was clear. Foreign investments earned considerably more than the returns available domestically. Overall, one researcher of British capital migration concluded, preoccupation with dividends nurtured the growth of a rentier governing class whose interests lay outside the community in which they lived and exerted influence. British historian Paul Kennedy, the dean of great power decline theorists, has emphasized the interplay of finance and the demands of war in charting the fates of Spain, the Dutch Republic, and Imperial Britain. Finance not as a late stage of national evolution, but as a sinew, and sometimes an Achilles heel, of a great power's military capacity. Kennedy was moved to note, however, that this is not to say that the financial element always determined the fate of nations. We will revisit this relationship in Chapter 10. Because intermittent high debt ratios were so central to the evolution of each of the leading world economic powers, each became comfortable, too comfortable, with debt as a long-standing experience, practice, and tactic. Particular overconfidence was instilled by memories of how often previous debt problems had been surmounted, even at extreme levels, 100 to 200% of GDP or GNP. A few examples will make the point. By the time of its real peril in the 1630s, and despite growing cynicism, the Spanish kingdom had survived five previous royal bankruptcies, 1557, 1575, 1595, 1607, and 1627. Interest rates were still surprisingly low, and the prior ebbs of silver shipments from Mexico and Peru had been followed by renewed flows. The embattled Dutch nation, in turn, had been surrounded by enemies and water at birth and was used to sticking its finger in financial dikes, as well as in the sea-restraining versions. The fact that its national debt rose to painful heights after the wars of 1689 to 1713 did not elicit the concern it should have. In the London of 1900 and 1914, complacency about Britain's rising debt in the aftermath of the Boer War reflected industrial triumph after previous surges of war-related indebtedness. Men including David Hume and Adam Smith had doubted the nation's ability to survive the debt burden left by the several wars with France. In 1752, Hume had forecast national bankruptcy by the end of the century unless the trend reversed. However, although the Napoleonic Wars carried British debt to a new height, nearly 300% of GDP as measured in the 1820s, even that was surmounted despite severe pressures during the depressionary decade after Waterloo. By the 1850s, the historian Thomas Macaulay could scoff at the same cry of anguish and despair that had always proved wrong. Britain quickly shrank the Napoleonic War debt with the profits from its manufacturing hegemony during the 1840s and 1850s, as factories and exports justified the description of Britain as the workshop of the world. Then, the hubris began to set in. Understandable as this cockiness might be, history teaches a crucial distinction. Nations could marshal the necessary debt-defying high-wire walks and comebacks during their youth and early middle age, when their industries, exports, capitalizations, and animal spirits were vital and expansive, but they became less resilient in later years. During these periods, as their societies polarized and their arteries clogged with rentier and debt buildups, wars and financial crises stopped being manageable. Of course, clarity about this develops only in retrospect. However, even though war-related debt seems to have been part of each fatal endgame, the past leading world economic powers seem to have made another error en route. They did not pay enough attention to establishing or maintaining a vital manufacturing sector, thereby keeping a better international balance and a broader internal income distribution than financialization allowed.